Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. There are a million and one ways to practice meditation. And so you have to have confidence in your own experiment and observing yourself and seeing what kind of a person you are, but also what the tone of the mind is in each situation, because it's always very variable where your energies are at and what kind of moods are coming up and the time of the day, if you've just eaten. So many factors make up any given period of meditation. So first and foremostly, having a sense of what's going on right now is very important, obviously, rather than just kind of jumping into a technique. So how is it now? A kind of awakening of the mind. What's your body like? You got a lot of pain. What's the mood of the mind? Are you negative? Or is there a lot of dullness? Things like that. So there's a sense of truly awakening to the whole experience of being at any particular point in the meditation, your mind-body experience. And from that, we all make experiments, and then we discover what things work for us, and we get more consistent with those things that work for us. And then we also discover certain things to do when we are dull or when we're restless or whatever. So that craft of meditation becomes honed over the years, and you find more and more confidence, more and more interest in the practice. So whatever a teacher offers you is just usually from their own experience or maybe from some book learning. But the base, really, the nub of it is the awakened mind, not bound by grasping to the khandhas, not bound by the addiction to distraction, not bound by the endless preoccupation with stuff, mind stuff, body stuff, emotional stuff, 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 stuff. And so the way I have been trying to encourage that is this, through the three characteristics, through this very simple way of things like that this experience is in awareness. That's the way I approach the teachings on anatta. This is in awareness. So if you're doing like body meditation, and body meditation is, there's so many aspects to that which are helpful and skillful. Breath meditation, chakra knowing, knowing tension. But what seems to me very important is to make sure that you, in awareness of the body, you include your head. That you're not working from your head, but your head is in awareness. That to me seems very primary to getting a sense of non-grasping, of the, knowing the body formations, but not being a kind of person who is meditating to get something, this kind of grasping of situation. That usually comes from the head, from the eyes, instead of trying. Well, when I do that, when I say that the head is in awareness, that the eyes are in awareness, there's a kind of largeness to the awareness which includes bodily formation in a way which is where bodily formation is seen as a flow in nature rather than me being in the body doing something, some kind of practice. And that perception I found is just quite unspectacular or almost seemingly insignificant. This experience is in awareness. Doesn't seem like much. So I found if I persist with that, the body is in awareness, that the eyes are in awareness, the emotional life is in awareness. If I persist with that, then there's a kind of intuition or sense of non-grasping which begins to, it's very hard to explain, it just begins to operate, I suppose. Non-grasping begins to operate. very hard, because any sense of I am operating just somehow doesn't work. Anyway, that you pick up something like that, like that this is taking place in awareness. Now that's not an extreme experience like deep peace or happiness or fear, whatever. It doesn't have that kind of holding quality of a experience of sense experience. And sense experiences hold our attention, don't they? Painful knee, a memory of something nasty that happened to you, a thought of something pleasant you might do. These are very definite kind of, they have qualities, they have character, they have strength. And so we're very much drawn to that. We're drawn to experience them as we have to. You have to taste the soup you're making to make sure it has a good taste, and you have to live in the world that way. But well, we're trying to discover something absolutely much, much, much more subtle, much more hard to actually notice. And that the way we talk about that is non-grasping, non-attachment. And that's very often misperceived, non-attachment, non-grasping, very much misperceived as having no emotional experience, or somehow that it is a kind of bland vacuum of non-experience. But within a strong experience like pain or emotional pain, physical pain, memory, whatever, what is non-grasping within that? Because no matter what you do, you still have a sense body, you still contact and feeling are working, you have memory. That's just part of the flow of consciousness that takes place. Well, what's non-grasping within just the naturalness there? And the way I approach that is this happening in awareness. So the drama of the sense experience still kind of comes and goes, but the reference is no longer the experience itself, but the knowing, the awareness, the witnessing. We have individuality. And that's one of the things that confuses people around the teachings of anatta. Is the kind of anatta, the misperception again, is like that, like there is no experience, but there is experience, and it's individual. Your experience of today was different than my experience of today. So there is individuality, that's for sure, isn't there? Can't deny that. So sometimes people think that anatta is pointing to no individuality, but that's not. That's obviously not true. Your memories are different than mine. The way you tasted your fruit this morning was different than the way I tasted my fruit, even though it seems to be the same fruit. So individuality flows through awareness. And knowing individuality is you can't help but do it. Each of us has our own individual situation. You can't help but be with that. But the way of non-grasping, the way of non-attachment is to know it as a flow rather than to be caught and preoccupied with it through judgment, liking, disliking, and the attachment to craving. So this way of stepping out or stepping back or knowing that the head is in awareness, the eyes are in awareness, the out-breath is in awareness, there's a perception, a way of considering, it's a perception that I find I need to keep bringing up, making conscious, and if I keep making it conscious, then the profundity of awareness begins to dominate, not through my willfulness, more through a change of narrative, change of perspective, change of attitude, change of whatever way of looking at things, change of perception. So coming back to body awareness, I noticed that some people tend to be, I kind of suspect, chronically dull. If you're chronically dull, then one of the things it was very helpful to learn how to do is to learn how to lock your hara down and out. So if you find that you think you were meditating, but you're not sure if you were meditating, and the bell surprises you, then you're probably chronically dull. So the bobbing and all of that. And I noticed that I was doing a survey, I'm watching you, by the way. And if you feel self-conscious, you should be. So the brownies are winning. So in a sitting this morning, the brownies had 80% nodding. The whiteies had 25% nodding. And the lay people had 0% nodding. So the brownies are definitely winning in the nodding department. Which I don't know if that's really how it should be, but that's the way it is. So if I may encourage everyone to contemplate, how do you bring vitality into your practice? How do you prevent yourself from just becoming a kind of a kind of nodding dullard? And you want to be really careful in that, because you can get your posture nice and comfortable and the pain is gone and you're just sort of almost there. But you can just see it in the posture and head's nodding, 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 not quite there. And no vitality in the posture, no strength in the posture, no virya in the posture. It's kind of too rounded, too soft, kind of what it looks like. I don't know. So the way to do that is to really learn how to develop your hara, to learn how to push down, down and out, until it locks. And then when it locks, you can hold it for a long time. But that you need muscle for that if you've never done it. So if you're sitting with your knees higher than your hips, that's going to be really hard to do. So if you can sit flat, can you sit flat and do that? Or you sit half lotus or full lotus, and then at least your knees are not higher than your hips. But if you're sitting like this and you haven't got something under your butt, and then you're trying to push your back up, you're going to have a lot of back strain. So if you're going to sit if you can sit Burmese style or half lotus or full lotus, then you don't need anything under your butt. But if I may suggest, if you're going to sit like I am now, then you really should be putting something under your butt so that your hips are higher than your knees, so that you're pushing forward with your hips so that you can raise your spine, right? Otherwise, you just think about it. Your knees are here, right? And your butt's on the ground. Okay, now your knees are pushing you back. Your knees are pushing you back. So you've got to strain yourself to get up just to kind of almost straight. So you're going to get tired and you're just going to go like that. And as you go like that, that crushes your hara and your chest, and you got less air, you got less energy. Right? So although it's very brave and noble and ascetic to not use a cushion, now, you see, I've got the best wedge in town. But it's not just because I'm a wimp. You know, I've done my ascetic practices on concrete. It's actually very pragmatic. That's why people use benches and things like that. So do look at that. What are you doing with your spine? Because you don't want to strain it either. You don't want to hurt it. But can you really launch up if your whole weight is pushing you back? So do, you know, have a look at that. Have a look at your posture and think about, like, if you want to develop a posture where you're not on a cushion, that's good. It's really great for Asia because it's hard to get a cushion. But also consider how can you get out of a kind of chronic dullness. So I find that, like, just put a lot of effort over the years in just learning how to push the hara forward, push down, and then lock it in. And the body likes that. Keeps it up nice and strong at the base. And then the rest seems to take care of itself. So have a look at that, because that's, to me, the sort of primary way of dealing with dullness, except for coffee. that's another way. All right, so there's that. Complexity. You know, you'll find in the meditative life, sometimes a very complex object of meditation is very helpful. Sometimes it's not. But complexity is, like, it's Tibetan tradition, they use complexity a lot. They'll take a, I've never done it myself, but it's been explained to me, they'll take a complex visualization of a deity. So they'll take a tanka and actually memorize the visual details. I could never do that. Then they'll have a complex mantra that they're applying to that, and then they'll up the ante and have a complex series of mudras they do. When I first ran into that, I said, wow, you can do that? But some people seem to be able to do that. Well, what's the point of that? Well, it keeps your mind busy, but busy in a very directed way, not in busy in a kind of distracted way. And apparently it has really powerful effects. So you find complexity in Theravada through like 32 parts of the body. That's a complex series of hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin that you visualize and go through. So what's the point of that? Well, it keeps your mind preoccupied in a very directed way towards the body, and you do piece by piece, and that means you have to kind of stay in the routine. Because you have to stay in the routine, it helps you stay in the present moment. Or if you look at like some of the ways of metta bhavana, like very complex ways of five factors per being, and then five beings, and then different types of beings, and then this direction, that north, south, east, west, zenith, nadir, and so on. So you get these very layering, complex layerings of beings and people and word phrases around metta bhavana. What's the point of that? Well, once again, you have to stay on topic. So some people like that. I don't like that kind of complexity myself, but you can see the point of it. So say take something like I suggested at the morning meditation, and I would ask actually if everyone could do this on the retreat, do at least one session, the beginning of a meditation session, go through the names of each person on this retreat and wish them well. It's a bit complex, not so complex. And just begin with Ajahn Viradhammo, Ajahn Sachitto, Tan Suvijano, Tan Chinda, Tan Kima. So go through the whole Sangha, all the lay people, and bring them to heart, wish them well. Bring them to heart, wish them well. Bring them to heart, wish them well. Now that is just marginally complex, but if you can't do that, then you're probably lazy. So it's a good way to look at laziness. Sometimes when we get too passive in meditation, when someone suggests something complex, I don't want to do that and fall asleep again. So complexity can be helpful for dullness. But on the other hand, complexity can be just a busyness. We just, oh God, I could keep doing all these lists. So it can be counterproductive too. It can be not effective according to time, place, and character. But anyway, during this retreat, maybe if everyone would do that, just take the first part of one of the meditations, and many ways to do it, but the way I like to do it is I name the person, and again, I take him to the heart chakra, and then may you be well, right to the end of the out-breath. And I don't rush to the next person on the in-breath. I pick them up, and then on the in-breath, real slow. So one at a time, and go through. I did that many times today. Feeling's very good, very wholesome. So I suggest everyone try that and see what happens if you do that for 3 months. See how you feel about each other. And if there's one person you're having difficult with, guess what? And then just see that can be a very effective thing, but also you can just feel like I'm always doing. So I wouldn't want that to be all the time. So then there are practices which are very simple, very simple. Do nothing. That's very hard just to do nothing, because the very suggestion to do nothing is a doing, isn't it? But that's the ultimate simplicity, where you sit and just, this is the way it is now. And that can be very, very fruitful, very, very fruitful. But if you're falling asleep, so that kind of a practice is helpful when you have a lot of vitality and you have a lot of presence, you're here. Whereas if your mind's very scattered and wandering and dull, then you need different kind of vitality. But if you have some level of samadhi, some level of stillness, or your mind just appreciates openness rather than focus. Sometimes, and some minds appreciate openness more than focus. Some minds appreciate focus. Some minds, if they focus, they get tight and uptight and tense, so they need more space. And so, like, this taking place in awareness is a very spacious practice. The body is in awareness, very spacious. So I don't know what kind of a character you are. You can only know that. But see, there are ways where you can take the breath and you can intensely focus on the nostrils. And then that might be very skillful. You might be able to hold it and really calm the mind. Another person might get a headache. That's why when I was talking about meditation, I really notice your eyes. Or things like when you, at the end of the out-breath, really notice your hands, notice your eyes, and notice what happens on the next in-breath. Is there anticipation? Do your hands get tense? Even in a little way. Because quite often at the end of the out-breath, either our minds wander and we fall asleep, or we have an anticipation. It's not big, but you begin to enter into these more subtle things as you're meditating. So complexity has its usefulness. So I often recommend memorizing the Metta Sutta. This is what should be done. And that, you know, most of us know that one. But just consider if to do the Metta Sutta slowly takes a kind of controlled presence around a bunch of words which have very good meaning. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. And who knows the path of peace? Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. And that's very calming. Now, when we memorize chants, usually we know them so well that it just becomes one word triggers a network, triggers the next word, triggers the next word. But when we have to do it slowly, we forget, or our minds wander. So that's complex. It's just marginally complex. But actually, we can be very skillful, because then you have to, first of all, you have to memorize the sutta. And you have to kind of lay it out in a way which requires a lot of mindfulness. And then, say, that sutta has such a beautiful meaning, really beautiful meaning, that it brings forth very wholesome aspirations and wholesome attitudes to life. So that's a bit complex, not very. It's much more different than do nothing. Different. So it could be very skillful. Yoga Nidra. Yoga Nidra is lying meditation. And again, just to walk you through that, or lie you through that. So Yoga Nidra is taking Sarvasana as your posture and setting up the corpse posture in a way that is comfortable. Warm back, you're not cold. And then using the lying posture as your basic grounding, trying to stay awake is the hard thing. You gotta figure out how to do that. But if you figure out how to stay awake in sitting posture, you figure out how to do it in a lying posture. And then you take the posture and you don't move. That's the real crucial thing, don't move. So you're laying there, don't move. And then as soon as you feel any discomfort, use the discomfort, make it fully conscious. Let it come up into consciousness. And this way of body meditation, where you're allowing the bodily feelings to come up into consciousness, is the way of this is taking place in awareness. And as you do that, when you feel the discomfort and you don't move, then that deepens your awareness, because now you're not reacting to the body, I want to be comfortable, in a habitual way. Now awareness knows discomfort. So what happens there, if you can get out of the I-making, my-making, thinking mind and come more to a sense of empty knowing without the whole proliferation of self going on, by using the body, by making letting the body become conscious. You can start by using the face first, like I was teaching earlier. Use the mouth, ears, nose, eyes, head, arms, chest, pelvis, legs. Do that. Go through that way, but make each part of the body conscious. Let it become conscious. And then after a while, you get a kind of global whole body awareness of the body. Kind of whole body, whole sense like the body in awareness now. Include your head in that. So the head is in awareness, the eyes are in awareness. And so you begin to feel the whole body as not a concept or a lump of conceptualized flesh, but rather the boundaries of body begin to be felt different because it's an energy form. Then you play around. You say, listen to sound. This is in awareness. Feel the body. This is in awareness. So really the sense of awareness becomes stronger and stronger rather than me being in the body. And then what might happen, maybe it's not typical, but I've talked to people who have the same kind of experience, then you start to maybe get little electrical charges coming out to your skin. Just little like pinpricks of, I guess it's electricity, whatever it is. Anyway, little pinpricks of feeling, sensation. Now don't scratch those, but see if you can just allow them to be. And what often happens is you get a lot of jerking. You just get your arm will just fling up, or your shoulders will go like that. You can get a lot of that kind of release going on. And that can go on. They go on for an hour and a half sometimes, half an hour, 10 minutes, maybe not take place. But allowing that to take place starts to really relax the body very deeply. Start to just kind of, all the tensions in the body get released in this rather dramatic way. So you have to just trust that's okay, that you're not developing some kind of disease. It's quite all right, it's not dangerous. And the temptation is then to scratch, because these are just little pinpricks. They come up through the skin, and they are precursors of kabang. And right there, you try to be very empty. Allow this experience just take place, and then there's a release. So the thinking mind doesn't want to do that. So if you're always thinking and trying to do something, you're just being thought. You won't notice that. So you're trying to let go of thought. And just allow the body feelings to become conscious. Let this posture become conscious. So as that release takes place, and again it can go on for a long time, the body starts to feel this deep, deep, deep relaxation. And then that posture it's not held anymore. It just is. It just is. And then you have a posture now which is very relaxed, and the need for effort becomes much, 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 much more subtle, because there's no need to hold anything anymore. Even to hold a body still, it's not relevant. And so the sense of the doer becomes very easy to investigate. The sense of a meditator becomes quite easy to observe effort now. Because, you know, really, there's no need for much effort. And that's where you start to get considerations of don't do anything, do nothing, no effort. Because now there's a stillness, a relaxation that is full, it's very vibrant, very alive. And that posture then, it's quite easy to be with that for a long period of time. And then the observation becomes more subtle, and more subtle things are noticed. So the subtleties of trying to get something, trying to figure something out, the kind of underlying restlessness of tanha, of bhava, begins to be noticed, and that begins to relax. And then there's the more release, and little pinpricks come up, and there's more release. So it's a very interesting posture to explore. Of course, many people find they just fall asleep. It's all right. Probably need to sleep. Then one thing to do is then when you come out of it, just stay there. Okay, oh, I'm falling asleep. Well, fall asleep. But then when you wake up, don't go anywhere. Just go back into the posture, see what happens. That's one way to discover it. Probably there'll be no one in the shrine room tomorrow. Where did everyone go? Anyway, and this is also an old man's reflection, posture. But yoga nidra is very hard, actually. Savasana is actually a very hard posture to do correctly. But if you want, I would say it's an interesting one to explore. But if you take the same principles then to sitting posture and body awareness, when you're holding your posture, try to look at things like this is in awareness, whole body, or not just in your head, trying to get something, and whole body awareness. Look at the end of the out-breath. Look at that, the grasping of the next in-breath, non-anticipation. See your hands. What are your hands doing? What's your face doing? So that at the end of the out-breath, there's no squeezing of the hands to get the next breath. No squeezing of the eyes looking for something. And that you can do just by observing. You just observe that. You get really good at it. So the end of the out-breath becomes really informative. Very informative. Then if you're sleepy, the end of the out-breath, use the full breath, really, really deep breath, and the rising of the spine, pushing down the spine. Learning to lock in the base of the spine so you get a good, strong posture. So the body is really a marvelous object of awareness. You can learn a lot. The three characteristics you can contemplate in it. Virya, energy, how do you do that? Calming the mind. Going to the heart chakra for metta bhavana. It's really, it's a marvelous field of inquiry and field of understanding, because the body is intelligent. It has its intelligence if we just give ourselves a chance to listen to it. And usually our intelligence up in thought is not so intelligent. The kind of prejudice and fears and so on that our thinking mind produces are pretty stupid sometimes. I don't know about you, but mine does. and we get fooled by those things, don't we? Our self-doubts and our judgments of others and our fears and so on. But the body doesn't really lie. The body just tells it how it is. So listening to the body, experimenting in these energetic ways, rather than just conceptual, you learn a lot, and then the body begins to be a place that you can always respond to life from, like the heart chakra, learning to abide with that, hearing the heart, and learning to relate to people from the heart is a very, very accurate way of relating, rather than from judgments and the head. We still use intelligence, sure, but I think the wisdom of the body quite often is neglected. All right, I'll leave that for consideration. Annamayam dhamma gataya sadhu karangadamase.